Good evening. This is the September meeting of the Health Commission. Welcome everybody who's in the audience. The first order of business will be the approval of the minutes of the August 11th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? All right. There being no additions or corrections, I would look for a motion to accept the minutes as written.
Move to approve as written.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any objections? Good. All right. All right, next comes the public comment period. At this time, anyone who wishes to make a comment about an item that is not on our agenda is welcome to come forward and have 3 minutes to make your comment. Please state your name.
My name is David Broadwater. Good evening. Is this the microphone and is it working?
Yeah.
Not used to that. My name is David Broadwater. I'm with the Center for Sludge Information, and what I'm here to do is give you a heads up. What we're talking about here is the land application of sewage sludge, which, as some of you may know, is a highly concentrated bunch of contaminants that are extracted at sewage plants to make the effluent coming back out of the plant as clean as possible. The Environmental Health Division of the Health Department has been circulating since late July a proposed permanent ordinance which would permit the land application of sewage sludge. That comment period is open until December 1st. After that, the Environmental Health Division states that they will write another draft and then there will be another comment period. Some of you know, the Health Commission has been very involved in this issue in past years. And has issued some very influential conclusions and reports to the Board of Supervisors. So I ask you that you would consider doing that again. And I brought a hard copy of an email. Gene White was good enough to forward that email to members, and I hope you all got that, which was just this brief one-page heads up about some of the positive elements that are in this ordinance, as well as a copy of the ordinance itself, which is only a couple pages long at this point. So I would encourage you to pay attention to this. It has the potential to seriously affect the health of members of the public who buy their food that's grown here, who drink the water, who breathe the air. A lot of these contaminants can gas off and get into the atmosphere. Under the regulations, no synthetic chemicals, including endocrine disrupting compounds or other toxics that are concentrated in sewage sludge, such as PCBs or dioxins or pharmaceuticals that are all excreted and concentrated in sewage sludge. None of those are regulated at all. The only regulated elements in sewage sludge are 9 of the heavy metals that are included in the material and 1 indicator pathogenic organism. Everything else is unregulated. Just to give you an example, the background of cadmium in soil compared to average agricultural soil concentrations in this state under the state and federal regulations would be allowed to increase by a factor of 57 times beyond its background level. That's just one example of what would happen, and that would be allowed under this ordinance as well. But there's some good elements about this one. This ordinance, but there are also some huge holes, gaping holes that will have to be fixed for this ordinance to be adequately protective of the public health. There are a number of, ordinance calls for sewage sludge only to be applied to land where food is being produced or animals are being grazed, which then presents an issue for food and fiber production and a health pathway that might be of concern to the commission. So if anybody has any questions, I won't be rude, but I do have to go off to another meeting at the Ag Liaison Board, so I'm...
Well, thank you for your comments. Does anybody have any questions of...
David, you said this ordinance was suggesting that it was okay to land apply on food crops?
Yeah, the only land that would be permitted for the land application of sewage sludge under this draft ordinance would be agriculturally zoned land that that's currently producing either food or being used for grazing. Now, of course, I'm not an advocate of expanding the types of land that sewage sludge should be applied to, of course, but that does raise the issue in terms of food contamination.
There was a lawsuit, I think, the last time that we met as a formal task force that was going on in the Central Valley about the sludge being deposited there from Southern California. Do you know the resolution of that?
That's been a huge, a resolution is a ways off. That's been a battle that's been going on since the late 90s in Kern County. They were accepting one-third of the state's, all the state's produced sewage sludge in Kern County alone. And there was a huge political upheaval, and they clamped down on some of the regulations requiring only Class A sewage sludge, and I could explain that if you wanted, but it's a lower bacteria amount. And then that turned it, that political and environmental issue turned into a legal one where the counties of L.A., San Diego, and Orange County went to court. And that's an ongoing brouhaha over there. And I don't know that it's, so far, my understanding is the ordinance that they passed stands. But there have also been legislative challenges based on that and others in that legislation has been written out of the county of L.A. to eliminate all counties' abilities to regulate the land application of sewage sludge and have to give up their local control and defer to the state and federal government. That was successfully fought by a broad, including our county. Our county joined that fight, and we stopped that. So we still maintain local control.
Thank you for that update. I also have a concern because the EPA is the one that regulates what they test for, and they haven't even updated any of the endocrine or neurotoxic contaminants, have they?
No. There's been... Since we started this battle in this county and learning about this in 98, and the Health Commission had its own task force that lasted for over a year and did a lot of study. It's a very complex subject, very technical and scientific, but there has been a lot more information now coming out about toxic substances, endocrine disrupting, hormone mimicking compounds, pharmaceuticals, in the sewer systems and in the sludge. Where they are finding now, even in the effluent, even at the level of detection, which is now down to the billion parts per milliliter, where there are effects on aquatic life forms, fish, etc. So it's a huge concern. Nine heavy metals and one indicator organism is the only thing under federal and state regulations that are regulated. All this other stuff is unmonitored, unmeasured, and unlimited.
Thank you. David, I just wanted to thank you for coming in to talk to us, and thank you for all your work on this subject. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to make a public comment? Okay, I would like to follow up on a public comment that was made last month. During the meeting, Patty Nolan brought up an issue regarding the Valley Fever deaths in the California Valley. And our epidemiologist, Ann McDowell, reviewed the death certificates for all residents of California Valley for 2007 and 2008, and none of them had Valley Fever listed as a cause or contributing factor in their deaths. She also cross-referenced the list with all cases of communicable disease reported to the Public Health Department and found none of them reported as Valley Fever cases. So I just thought that was... we had said we would get information, and so that's what we found. Okay, let's move on then to our program this evening. our first subject is going to be on the National Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Awareness Day, which is September 9th, tomorrow. and we have with us Lisa. Where'd Lisa go? There she is. Lisa Frazier and Jan Campbell, welcome.
The microphone right here. Good evening. thank you, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate this opportunity to come talk before you about the latest efforts and activities that we've been doing this past year. I represent the San Luis Obispo County Child Abuse Prevention Council. We're a nonprofit organization that has been functioning in San Luis Obispo since 1987. We do a variety of prevention, awareness, education outreach, and we also coordinate like-minded individuals and agencies together to make sure that we're working in a collaborative manner and the approaches of educating our community about child abuse and neglect. One of the activities that I'm very proud to talk about today is our new campaign to promote National Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Day, which is tomorrow, September 9th. And annually across the nation, this is an activity that many, many folks in many states go out and make sure that our community is aware about the consequences of using alcohol during pregnancy. And I have to please forgive me, I was given a little media piece on the way. That's what I was waiting for. Is it possible for me to have it shown? It only takes 3 seconds. Okay. But I'll go ahead and talk a little bit. I have here with me tonight, I have two guests with me that will be talking about the work that we're doing throughout the county to promote the awareness of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. In addition to that, I have a representative from Martha's Place, the Children's Assessment Center, that one of their specialties is to really work with children who are identified as being born to substances during the pregnancy. And part of what we want to do is not only promote the education to our providers, our health providers in the county, but also promote the awareness to our young people who are drinking, Cuesta and Cal Poly students, high school students, as well as the general public. So we have several activities that we're launching with the support of the First Five Commission of San Luis Obispo County. We recently received a small grant from the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation that helped us bring a curriculum into the high schools. We did that this past year with our partners, ALPHA, who is a nonprofit pregnancy and support organization here. They delivered it to over 249 youth at risk who learned about the consequences of using any kind of substances while if you were pregnant, how it affects the fetus. And is that media piece ready to go? Okay. So basically, the information I have, some brochures. 49 youth at risk who learned about the consequences of using any kind of substances.
We know that children with fetal alcohol syndrome will continue to struggle all their lives, and the challenges that the parents meet alongside their children in the early school years will be the same challenges they face as they reach adolescence.
So basically that we're here today to just make you aware that this will be our second year of promoting this awareness out in the community. We're just beginning to get our resources and our tools in place to be able to do this on an ongoing basis every year. I'm going to go ahead and have Jan Campbell come and speak before you about our partnership.
Good evening. I'm Jan Campbell. I'm the Maternal Child and Adolescent Health Director with the county. And I've been involved with perinatal substance use, not personally, but I have been involved in the campaign against using substances during pregnancy for now 5 years. And I did a couple of slides because I just want to let you know where we're at with that whole program. We implemented a assessment program called the 4Ps Plus in December of 2003. It's a program that is with our OBs in the county that we assess. We would like to assess all pregnant women. We're not at that point yet, but most of our providers are involved in the program. They use an assessment tool asking specific questions to our moms when they come in for their first visit to determine whether there is any use or has been any use during pregnancy. And then they go from that point on and give them a brief intervention or refer them to an appropriate support service that they have. We, at this point, we're at about 50%, a little more than 50% of all births in this county have been assessed, which is a good feat for us. We're still working on, I'd like to see that at 100%. I don't know if we'll be there, but that's our goal. And the physicians right now, many of them are targeting our Medi-Cal clients because of a program called Comprehensive Perinatal Services Program, which is a program that actually pays them through Medi-Cal to educate their Medi-Cal clients on health, psychosocial, nutrition issues. And so they'll take that time and do that assessment and talk to them and be able to be reimbursed for it. We do have two bills at the state. AB 2129, I believe, is one of them. We're working with, we have given some information to one of the assemblymen, Jim Beal, at the state level, who is wanting to pass a, not a mandate, but a recommendation statewide that all pregnant women be screened with a tool. And then the bill that's being held up is the bill that actually would support this financially. And, of course, with our budget the way it is at the state, it's kind of sitting in that little room that it goes to when they don't want to make a decision on that bill. The next slide will just show you where we're at now. We started in 2003, and I remember when we first started this, and I think Sue was in on that first part. I think we were all shocked that we had such a high percentage of women in our county that had used either alcohol, tobacco, or marijuana in the first trimester or that first month before they knew they were pregnant. But as you can see in the efforts that we've done throughout these 5 years, we are continually going down. The blue or the kind of purple bar there are the positive, and that means that when we ask women if in the months before they knew they were pregnant, did they use alcohol, tobacco, or marijuana, they said yes. The red line are the women that continued to use after they knew they were pregnant. I'd like to see that red line down to almost nothing, but it's going down. And so the efforts that we're making countywide have made a tremendous difference with our women and children in our county. I think it, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Nisha. We opened Martha's Place. Are you all familiar with Martha's Place? It's the Children's Assessment Center we have here in the county. It's been open now a year and a half, I want to say. And Nisha, Dr. Nisha Abdul-Cotter is the pediatrician and the medical director for the Martha's Place, and I was going to invite her up here to talk about. We work on the perinatal end. I want to stop the flow into Martha's Place is what I'd like to do. But because we do have children that have been prenatally exposed, it's really important that we have an assessment center for them so we can provide intervention. So, Dr. Cotter?
Thank you. Hello, I'm Dr. Nisha Abdul-Cotter, and I'm a pediatrician, and I've had the privilege of caring for many youth in this county under certain special circumstances. For the last 8 years, I've been a pediatric examiner for the suspected abuse response team. I'm conducting the vast majority of sexual molest cases in our county for children under 12. I also, for the last 5 years, have been the supervising physician at the juvenile service center. And of interest was I was just there today, and as I was going over charts there, I was noticing that about 25 to 30% of the children at juvenile hall are taking some kind of psychotropic medication at this point in time, including some of them for attention deficit syndrome. Well, the importance that has to do is kind of leads on to this third role that I'm involved with is my role at Martha's Place as a pediatrician. I've been a pediatrician there since it opened, and we saw our first patients in November of 2006, and I'm currently the clinical director as well. So Martha's Place is an assessment center, and it's also a treatment center as well, focusing on the 0 to 5 population. And as Jan said, we hope to end the inflow of kids going in there. But to let you know, what we're really looking for are children that are at risk. And the reason we use the term at risk is because many of the times we don't know who has been prenatally exposed to drugs or alcohol. We have many children who are referred to our center who are foster family kids, and we don't know their birth history. What we know of as what is at risk in the 0 to 5 population are children whose brains may have been infected prenatally by some kind of substance or even postnatally by some kind of traumatic event. So I have to say that there's a large overlap between the children I see at the abuse center and the children we also see at Martha's Place Children's Assessment Center. At this point in time, we've seen nearly 170 children come through for some form of assessment. Sometimes it's just a medical assessment, but most of our children come in for a full assessment, What that means is once the child is referred, usually by social services, sometimes through Head Start, even biological families have referred children in, we have a public health nurse who does an initial screening, sends out something which is called the Ages and Stages questionnaire and the Ages and Stages social-emotional questionnaire, where we do a rough screening on the child's progress. Because what we can see as far as at-risk issues can be developmental. A child may not be meeting their developmental milestones. They may be behavioral issues. A child has tantrums or aggression that is not common in their age group. Or it may be social-emotional issues that the child is not able to engage with another adult. Sometimes if an attachment was not made in the early childhood stages, they're not able to have the normal kind of consequential relationships then for the rest of their childhood. So those are some of the high-risk things that are then referred in. Once we identify these children that pass the screening, we have a therapist do a home visit with that family, and they can see the child in their home environment, do observations of the child, and fill out a complete psychosocial history. From that point in time, the child is then evaluated at Martha's Place, and we have this transdisciplinary team, so we have the report from the therapist, as well as then testing, either developmental or cognitive testing from a psychologist, as well as a pediatric evaluation. And the pediatric part is looking for facial features or any other features that may be related to fetal alcohol exposure, but any other thing that also may be going on with the child as well. We have children with other syndromes as well as other physical problems too, and so we pick up those issues when they come in. I wanted to let you know that the actual population of children that we see with full fetal alcohol syndrome is fairly low, less than 5%, and that's because to have the full-blown requirements for fetal alcohol syndrome, there needs to be deficiencies in growth, facial features, as well as a known exposure to alcohol. And so sometimes we don't have that documented known exposure to alcohol. So to have that complete syndrome, very difficult to get that diagnosis. But what we do see a lot of is what is called ARND, alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder. So those are children that may not have those facial features but have some developmental or behavioral issues that are most likely a consequence from that prenatal alcohol exposure. Once we get all of our findings together, the team gets together for a transdisciplinary approach of looking at the child to look at therapeutic options, mostly in the realm of mental health therapy, a lot of it having to do with attachment work, traumatic-based work, and then school-based work as well, so trying to get the child to have the best success that they can in school to prepare them, and that's why we're focusing at that 0-5 population at this point in time.
Thank you. Questions from commissioners. Commissioner Hetherington.
Thank you very much for coming, Doctor. How does that translate into the adult population? I mean, if you don't have the facial features, is there an easy diagnosis, say, when they mature into late teens, early adults, middle-aged people, and older people? Is there a trend that is identifiable?
I wouldn't say I know of the identifiable trend, but it's just leading up to it with that idea that so many of the youth we have in juvenile service center have different kinds of issues. I wouldn't be surprised if many of them do fall into that ARND category where they have some type of either development or a cognitive issue which makes them not able to have the same success in school or with relationships. And then once we have those problems developing and during the school ages, they continue on into adulthood and lead to adults that have a difficult time integrating into society.
Any other questions from commissioners to any of our speakers? Well, thank you so much. You were finished, were you, Lisa? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your taking the time to be here tonight and to bring us up to date on what's being done. We've followed this issue over the last few years, and we continue to be very interested. So thank you. There's someone in the audience that has a question. You're welcome to come forward and ask it if you would like to. Oh, we'd like you to come forward so that we can hear you and you can say who you are.
I'm Ann Brown. I'm a retired school nurse and actually served on the Health Commission in the first group. But I'm particularly interested in to whom you find you can refer for treatment, especially your Medi-Cal clientele.
I'll listen for an answer.
Okay.
We need the answers on paper. You can text me.
I mean youngsters who have been diagnosed with FAS.
Okay. Well, we're really fortunate with the collaboration that has happened in this county, and Jan and myself are fortunate enough to have just recently returned from Chicago at a meeting with Dr. Chasnoff, and we were able to see some of the other centers that and what they're doing in their respective communities, and to see the great collaborative efforts that are being done here in San Luis Obispo County are really encouraging, and specifically as with regards to the county mental health services that the mental health practitioners that we have at Martha's Place are county employees, and so they are getting their funding through EPSDT. And so about 75% of our clients are Medi-Cal clients, and so many of those children need therapy, and so the therapy for those children are mostly being cared for through Martha's Place at this point in time, just because we don't have that community base. Especially that is prepared to treat the 0-3 population.
Commissioner Warren. Yes, I have a question that when you're talking about most of the clients being Medi-Cal mm-hmm. clients, and I this comes back to when Jan was first speaking too, that the OBs are now essentially screening the Medi-Cal patients, and one of the issues that we've had from the very beginning is what about the rest of the general population, and how are we going to look at that population if we're not even going to test their moms? And are the schools, or, you know, how are we looking at that where we're not just saying, well, it's just those people that have the problem?
Absolutely. Well, one area is the Head Start program. They're one area that are actively screening the children so that they can be seen. What we're hoping to work on is a greater effort, actually, maybe more of a nationwide effort, or at least through the centers that are involved with the Chicago Center, working on a screening tool that can be used in the general pediatrician's office. So from that point, from the pediatrician's point, it's going to be a screening tool that will help to get the referral in. But as far as Martha's Place is concerned, we are working on expanding our billing options and therefore also our clinic staff so that we can have more private pay patients come in, as long as we have the guaranteed number of Medi-Cal children able to be seen as well.
I did want to address, we have two wonderful OBs in this county that are screening all of their patients. And data is showing that our population that has this problem, it's not our Medi-Cal population. It is the white, upper, middle class, educated women. And for San Luis Obispo, our number one drug of choice is alcohol. And we are, back in Chicago, I was laughing. I was telling other people back there, they were from all over the United States, and I said, we used to be the number one highest rate for substance use across the United States. We were bypassed by, I believe it was Alameda, and their drug of choice is marijuana. But we still are the number one for alcohol. And so we are really trying to address that with our OBs, that all women need to be assessed for that. But we do have, it's not just the Medi-Cal population on the OB side. Two of our physicians that see a good number of our clients. CHC does for all their clients, and then we have another physician in the county that does every one of his clients also. So we're getting there.
Any other questions? Thank you again. We certainly appreciate your being here. All right. Then we'll move along on that subject. Our next item is National Alcohol and Drug Addiction Recovery Month, September. And what are we doing in our county for treatment and prevention for families in recovery? And we have Raymond Seidens. Thank you very much for coming.
Good evening. Thank you for allowing me to come talk about what's happening with families when it comes to alcohol, drug, and addiction problems. I work at Coastal Psychiatric Care in Atascadero. I'm a therapist, and 2008 celebrates my 30th year in this field, so big milestone. Anyway, in terms of dealing with alcohol and drug addiction problems, I'd also like to expand that to include a couple of new areas. As service providers, we've been asked to expand the range of our services. At first, it was with alcoholism, then it expanded into drug addiction, and now we're looking at what we call the process addictions. That would include gambling addiction, sex addiction, spending addictions, things like that. The importance of that is that expands the scope of what we're trying to do with family members. So we're not just dealing with the family members and children of alcoholics and drug addicts, but we need to be skilled enough, those of us working in the addiction field, to deal with these other areas too. Some of the differences are very important when you're dealing with the family that has someone as a sex addict or gambling addict versus an alcoholic, and then some of the patterns are very similar and they can be integrated very smoothly into a treatment program. Another area that we're being asked to deal with is what's called co-occurring disorders, dual diagnosis. Co-occurring disorders means that for a long time in the past, we've sort of separated out psychiatric diagnoses from the addiction field. And what we're trying to do is blend those together so that we aren't independent of each other in trying to help people. We're trying to consolidate our efforts, make for smoother treatment for people. Co-occurring disorders means that somebody has a psychiatric problem in addition to their alcohol and drug problem. So we're trying to deal with the addiction side and the psychiatric side at the same time. Now, the offshoot of that is we need to do the same thing with the family members, including the fact that some family members have not been appropriately diagnosed themselves. For instance, we can have a family member who is also co-occurring in the sense that she is a codependent in addition to having a psychiatric problem. Now, what does codependent mean? That term is used a lot. Codependent is the term used to describe family members and those closely involved with an alcoholic or addict. Now, codependents sometimes are treated in kind of a negative way. It has a negative connotation. But most of the time, codependents, like many alcoholics and addicts, start out healthy. And in order to try and cope or adjust to the progression of the disease, they start doing some unhealthy things. But the attempt is to try and cope with this unmanageable problem. Unfortunately, some of their efforts start to boomerang on them. So what initially is trying to be helpful to maybe funnel the alcoholic or addict into treatment turns into enabling. Enabling is where you are doing things to try and help, but it ends up helping the alcoholic or addict avoid consequences of their behaviors, which doesn't help them get funneled into treatment. So the important thing with COs, the codependents, is that we need to get them involved in treatment, set them as a priority in treatment, just as much as we're doing with the alcoholic and addict. Now, in terms of that, what are we trying to do? Well, we're trying to take a systems approach. A systems approach means that we take a look at all aspects of treatment and not just focus only on the alcoholic or addict. And unfortunately, that's been the history of our field, is that we still tend to focus most of the outreach, prevention, and intervention efforts toward the alcoholic and addict. Well, a lot of those are still in denial. They're still struggling to come forward for treatment. And yet this whole population of family members is basically being ignored. So I think one thing that we need to really focus on is what can we do to increase the visibility, increase the efforts toward getting the codependents into treatment. It could be that by getting them involved in treatment first, you actually are going to have a greater success rate in terms of working with the alcoholics and addicts. And there's some research that supports that. For instance, the intervention technique, some of you have heard about that, where you do a formal intervention where the family members come together, you present data, hopefully get the alcoholic addict into treatment. Well, treatment programs have found that those have a higher success rate of completing treatment and staying abstinent. And I think the reason is pretty clear. The family members are well prepared so that when you hit those rough spots, it's a united front and everybody's involved in that. Whereas if family members are not included in treatment, they're vulnerable when their alcoholic or addict wavers during the treatment process. They're vulnerable to saying, well, we don't need treatment or we don't need to follow through on that. So that's a very important part in helping the alcoholic is having their family members, their codependents, either one step ahead or at least right next to them when it comes to treatment. Now, another part of the systems approach that we're having difficulty with is right now, in terms of the systems approach, you have the alcoholic or addict sort of driving things. You know, the codependents tend to be reactive. And I would suggest even our systems are reactive, that we tend to focus more on what the alcoholic is doing and what they're driving, as opposed to where our efforts with the codependents, the family members, the children of alcoholics. So I think it's important in any systems approach to avoid being reactive ourselves as treatment providers. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. The other part to this is by doing family treatment. A lot of places say, well, we can't really do that with our population because they've already lost families. They're low bottom alcoholics, addicts, and so they've lost families. No one wants to participate. But again, what we find is that those individuals still are from families. They still have some of their issues themselves that are factoring in to either chronic relapse problems or having difficulty in maintaining their own sobriety. So even if a program says, well, gee, a lot of our folks don't have families, I still think it's important to run groups and have family involvement and have those folks involved in that because they're going to deal with some of their unresolved issues from the past. Now that leads us to what's going on with the children of alcoholics. We're focusing maybe more on the spouse. But what about the rest of the family members? Well, we see what can happen physically with fetal alcohol syndrome. There are a lot of other medical problems, legal problems, all sorts of consequences that alcoholic families face. But with children of alcoholics, one of the key things is they are not going to pass through their developmental stages properly. They are going to get stymied in those stages. So the biggest psychological damage that is done is that they don't have an opportunity to grow in a healthy way. And their reference points are really distorted. If you're growing up in an active alcoholic family, you may not know what normal is. And because you tend to keep it a secret and keep this hidden, you don't get a chance to talk with other people and get some reality checks from them. So one of the big issues we see is that children will hold on to these unresolved issues. We call that untreated codependence. And so they will continue throughout their life, having been stuck in some of these issues, which can have lifelong impact on them. Now, eventually, that may also create a double trouble kind of situation where they may reenact what's gone on with the environment they grew up in. So that's why often we have surveys that show that children of alcoholics are more likely to become alcoholic or addicts themselves. And then especially if you factor in now the process addictions of gambling addiction, sex addiction, things like that, I think we'd see even higher numbers with that. So it's very important we get to our children so that we can help them go through the normal developmental stages with just the usual problems. You know, obviously there's going to be the usual things that they have to struggle with, but they're really being weighted down by this issue. Now, one thing that's important is we need to do a better job at assessing for that. A lot of times kids and adolescents come into treatment and they really are not assessed for their codependency. So I think it's important that we train our service providers so that they are invested in treating the family. Because when you start looking for issues, you find them. If you don't know how to look, if you don't know how to assess, you're missing the boat. So let's say an adolescent gets referred for some behavioral problems or school-related problems. Unless somebody is knowledgeable about addiction, they may not dig enough to find out that maybe what the real presenting problem is has to do with an alcoholic parent in the family. So that's the importance of having the co-occurring training so that we are not missing some very important issues. Okay, so whether it's in the probation system, school counseling, county, private sector, whatever it may be, proper assessment of the children to really explore, is there an active alcoholism or drug addiction problem in their family? Okay. Now, the other kind of syndrome is what we call adult child of alcoholics, ACOA or ACA. And that movement started years ago because of the recognition of people in our field that many adults were still struggling with issues that were directly tied in to growing up with an active addict. And yet those issues weren't really being addressed or helped that much in terms of traditional psychotherapy. And so the ACA movement basically started to attend to that issue and address some of these blocks, some of these unresolved issues that are specific to an alcoholic or drug addicted family. So there are a lot of folks out there who are untreated ACAs, who are still struggling with issues that may not be appropriately assessed unless it's someone who knows this field. Okay. So family recovery, what are we attempting to do? Well, as I'm sort of alluding to, is that one of the first things I think we should do is really identify and offer services to the codependents, regardless of whether their alcoholic addict is coming into treatment. And we have plenty of groups being offered to alcoholics and addicts, but it'd be interesting to see how limited it is with groups that are being offered to either children of alcoholics, the adolescents of alcoholics, or ACAs or other codependents. To do that, you have to be very invested in family. You have to really sell this to treatment providers and the families themselves. Right now, I think our field still is kind of soft on this issue, that we need to be more aggressive in saying, don't wait for your alcoholic to get into treatment, that for the good of you, the kids, we need to get you into treatment right away. That message isn't being given clearly enough. And I think that's one important thing we can do. Just like in general, a lot of the calls that come in for treatment, residential treatment, let's say, come from the family members anyway, that it isn't the alcoholic who's making that initial call. So we've got to do a better job at getting to the codependents and presenting them with good treatment options so they can begin their recovery. It's kind of ironic that, in a way, what we're doing is we're asking alcoholics to be healthier and volunteer for treatment, and yet they may be living with a sick family. So a lot of times I challenge families I'm working with, well, you need to set the stage for recovery. You know, don't wait for your alcoholic to take that first step. And how's he going to take that first step if you are not functioning well? Remember, codependents, they reach a point where they're really struggling with things. They're doubting themselves because they don't have trust with their alcoholic anymore. And so their own reality checks are questionable. So they're not functioning very well, and so they're prone to be making mistakes like enabling, getting angry, showing resentments, things like that, that don't really guide or interest an alcoholic or addict into treatment. But you get codependents who are going to Al-Anon or Families Anonymous or CODA treatment, and they are getting healthy, then they can truly start setting the stage for their alcoholic to get interested in recovery. Leaving books out, having friends come over who are talking about recovery, not overreacting or underreacting to things, stopping the enabling. All those things that healthy codes can do to set the stage for the alcoholic to want some of that too. Ultimately also, a codependent may have to set real firm boundaries. There may come a time where they use more of a tough love approach to say, I've given this setting the stage stuff enough time and you have not joined me in recovery, so therefore here's a boundary I need to set to maintain my mental health or to protect the children. And so it leads them to make a healthier decision rather than staying immersed indefinitely in an active alcoholic or addict situation. Okay. Make sense? Okay, I see a lot of nodding. I'm not used to not interacting, so if you have questions as we go along here, I don't have to give a monologue. Yes, go ahead.
Is it generally the case that if you have, say, a codependent person that's a family member but not the addict, does the insurance pay for them to be seen as well?
Well, typically they would have an individual diagnosis, depression, anxiety disorder, something like that, that they're being treated for legitimately. In the community sector, certainly, you know, that's available. And a lot of times in the private sector, people do negotiated fees, you know, especially people in the recovery field. There's always access to treatment. So I don't think that's a major issue in preventing CODs from seeking help. I think we have just been very slow because we're not advocates for family. It takes a lot of investment to do family work. And sometimes even for counselors, it's threatening because often with family work, you have to like being a referee. It's a bit unsafe at times because your family is the client. And you've got adolescents who are acting out, and maybe the alcoholic is trying to scapegoat one of the adolescents. And so you've got a big juggling act in terms of trying to get the family focused and trying to step by step help them all with recovery. The other thing is your family programs typically are only as good as your willingness to hustle. A lot of times programs give sort of cursory effort to family treatment and say, oh, family members don't show up. Well, what are you doing to call them? You know, don't go through the alcoholic. The alcoholic says, oh, they don't need to be here or they don't want to come here. But then if you make the call directly as a counselor and talk about these kind of issues and invite them in directly, they are willing to come in. So you've got to be careful that the system doesn't sabotage. And that can happen from different parts. The codes can sabotage things too because of their ambivalence about treatment. A lot of codes are very scared of treatment because it's threatening. At least they've got familiar right now. And sometimes human beings choose familiar over the unknown. So we have to sell them that this is familiar, but it's unhealthy. The unfamiliar can be healthier, and that's the direction that we want to go with them. So you have to be a real advocate for family. You have to hustle them in, you have to call them, you have to be willing to be a referee and take that role. And so for people who do that, then you get good turnout from family members. The other thing is in programs, don't exclude a family member because your alcoholic is bailed out. When I ran an inpatient program years ago, the standard was if your billable patient, the alcoholic, left the hospital, treatment was over. Well, our treatment wasn't over. My administrator at the time didn't know, but the family kept coming in 6 days a week for the family component of treatment. They kept coming to aftercare, the once-a-week groups. So we pretended as if nothing happened. Even though their alcoholic had taken a powder, they were still in treatment. We wanted them to get well. Our commitment was for them to get well. So you've got to be careful that you don't have programs that are conditional upon the alcoholic or addict. That sends a bad message to the family members. It says your second choice here, your not as valuable. And so we've got to make sure that that message isn't coming across to the family members. Okay?
Yes. It seems like you're talking about a huge number of people now. You're expanding this group of people that really need to be helped and identified and need help. Where are the resources? I mean, do we have that many people in this county that can be there to help, and Pam already asked about the insurance part of paying for it, but just the actual people who can do this work. Do we have adequate number of people in our county?
Well, that I don't know. Susan, you may want to address that.
I can speak to that a little bit. We've been speaking to this for about 20 years here that no, I don't think we do have adequate resources in this county. We have a few, like, sober living homes for the alcoholics, addicts. We don't have any residential treatment that would provide these kinds of family programs. I do know there's one with Cottage. If someone goes to Santa Barbara County and they're going to Cottage, but they need the insurance to get in there, there's a family program here when they come back. But other than that, other than peer support programs that are in every community in the county, we just don't have a lot of resources. There's a few individual therapists, but again, they're trying to make a living, and so they're not always going to pick up for Medi-Cal clients. And then that's a huge issue for this county, which is why I was hoping that we could begin to look at what the needs are. You know, we're helping these children. But there's family issues around this whole piece, and it really is big, and we really need to sit down and take a look at this.
But also, that should not prevent us from doing this kind of work now. So we do what we can with the resource we have, either in the private sector or public sector. But in a sense, the work needs to be done now, and it's a measure of something good happening if the resources are saying we're being overwhelmed by too many family members. I would love to hear that complaint. Maybe it helps motivate more funding, but at least it means we're getting the word out. The other thing is groups are very helpful. So if I'm running a codependence group and I have 8 to 12 people in one group for an hour and a half, that's a good, efficient use of time, and groups are very productive in this field. So whether it's an adolescent group, codependent adults, ACA groups, we can serve a lot of people in that group setting. The other really important part is that, thankfully, in this field, we have a lot of support groups out there. We have got AA, Al-Anon, Alateen, CODA, Families Anonymous. There is a lot out there that some of the other psychiatric fields don't have, you know. So in that sense, we've got an opportunity here if we can help get the clients invested in using the support groups that are out in the community. And a lot of those groups have plenty of room. Their Families Anonymous is just sort of getting started up here, and so there's some good stuff that can be had out there. And then the final thought is look at the consequences we're facing without this. For instance, another example is how many grandparents are now being involved in parenting? You know, that's not a very healthy position to be in, but we're seeing more of that, just like we see some of the other consequences that are occurring. Drunk drivings, age of use lowering for our teenagers, you know, just number after number. Even if we underestimate some of the research, it's still staggering how big this problem is. So I'm just presenting this idea that we are making a lot of effort toward the alcoholic and addicts, which is great. We don't need to change that. Let's increase it. But let's shift and bring this other new component that really is being underutilized, working with the family members of the codependents. Yes?
My concern is what you're talking about seems to me to be once you get the alcoholic past the crisis stage. And from what I've seen, we don't have a whole lot in this county on getting that done, unless you've got money. If you've got money and insurance, maybe there's a way to do it. But, and maybe, Susan, you can help me. What does a family do if they need to put someone, they need to help someone get through, a family member, and they can't afford the services? They're in a crisis. You know, they have an alcoholic who's in crisis. Where do they go if they don't have the money or the insurance to, I mean, what you're saying is wonderful, you know, to bring the codependents in, to bring the children of addicts in, and but what if you don't even have the money to even start down that road? Where do they turn in this county?
Well, where we've always sent them is to the peer support groups. Those are available 7 days a week, you know, 365 days a year. And they will find other family members and people that have been through it, and they can help walk them through. And if they're truly at a place where then they need to find therapists and they need to find some of these other treatment options and things, we can help them find those things, but they're going to be outside the county for the most part. The therapy we can find in here, but for treatment centers, we usually have to go outside the county within a... we actually have a place on our website where it's a national site, and you can go on there, but we tell them, you know, you have to go for the 90-mile radius, and then that'll give you all the surrounding counties. And if you're lucky, you'll find somebody that's got a spot that's open, because they're going to take their own county's folks first. So it's kind of a dilemma. So a lot of this does fall on the shoulders of the peer support groups, but there's also a lot of magic that happens in those peer support groups, because at least they can go in right that day and have somebody to talk to and have an immediate support system that's there for them 7 days a week. And so that kind of helps offset some of the crisis until they can put other things into motion, because it's going to take some research.
If somebody has a serious medical problem, then hospitals are required to take them. And as Susan is saying, even outside of the area, there are denominational residential programs. There are other counties that if you meet their requirement of having an address within their county, you can go into their social model program. And most of these social model programs are now connected with medical treatment and county mental health, so that if they need medication for a co-occurring disorder, that they will get that. If they've got other medical problems, they will get services for that. So our social model programs, which are kind of limited in this county, have expanded their role too. 30 years ago, social model programs would not take co-occurring disorders. They would not take people on medication or with medical problems. That was just seen as outside of the scope of what they could do. Well, now they're doing that. So when someone does need residential treatment, there still are places. You may have to research it and go out of the area, but there still are places, even if you don't have insurance.
I'm wondering if you have any estimate as to what percentage of our population you would consider to be alcoholics.
Well, again, Susan, I'll defer to you. You've been in the county longer, but in general, you hear statistics about anywhere from 1 in 25 to 1 in 50 that would have an active addiction problem. The numbers for how many people are affected by alcoholism are often quoted at 1 in 5. So look within your own personal life. You know, if you are looking at your extended family, you know, if there's been an alcoholic or addict in your family, and you're within those numbers, 1 in 5. So again, even if it's conservative estimates, you know, beyond what I've just said, it's still a big enough problem, and it so affects other areas, you know, the drunk driving accidents and people seeking medical treatment, the co-occurring disorders, people chronically going into expensive hospital treatment who are not maybe being treated as they should be for their addiction. In the private sector with work, all the cost you have with accidents on the job connected to alcohol or drug problems, absenteeism. So it's a huge issue. You know, in terms of devoting resources, I'm a little biased, of course. I think the mental health field needs more resources. But it does affect everybody. You know, it's a huge price we pay as a culture.
Well, I will say one thing that is happening because of the awareness that's happening nationally. Both at the federal and the state level, there are bills coming up to bring parity back to mental health and substance abuse issues with the insurers, that they will cover the substance abuse and mental health issues like they do any other chronic illness. And those are, I know there's a bill right now at the state ready for the governor to sign, and it's also, I'm not quite sure where it's at this point with at the national level, but they're working on the bills up there too. And yes, and it is Assembly Bill 1887 by Mr. Beal again. And so a lot is happening, and I think one of the biggest things that's going on is like the HBO series that's been run on addiction. That's helping educate people that this is an illness that needs treatment. Shows like Intervention. I've had an increase in phone calls where I work of people looking for intervention because they said, I saw that on TV. I didn't know you could do that. And we want to do that. So there's a, you know, there's just in various movies and things, you're hearing different actors and people, whether it's Law and Order or a movie, that they're beginning to refer to themselves as being in recovery. And there is a huge national movement, which is what we're celebrating this month, is the fact that it's nationwide to get people to understand that treatment works and people do wind up in recovery, and it does make for healthier families and individuals. And the important part is communities. I think if we ever really had the opportunity to look at how much money gets saved through law enforcement and emergency rooms, it would more than pay for itself. If we could get our legislators to understand what a turnaround it could make, because it's, like you say, we're not diagnosing, we're not assessing, so we're not understanding how big this problem is. And I know that we had talked about having one of the emergency room physicians come and talk to us, and I think that's still something we ought to take a look at, because I think they fill our emergency rooms, just like our sheriff said that that's what fills his jails. And if we had more treatment options open, and particularly to the family, people could be intervened on a lot sooner than before they wind up in the emergency room or in jail. And we could avoid a lot of hassle.
Now, one other point is that once the entire family is in treatment, we've got to encourage family members to work a parallel recovery program. So we've talked a little bit about family getting involved in treatment, even if their alcoholic or addict isn't in. But once they're in treatment, we still have to convince family members, you must work a parallel recovery program. You aren't there just for the alcoholic. You're there for yourself. Now, in terms of what do we do treatment-wise, especially with children of alcoholics, and adult children of alcoholics and the COs, is we're trying to get them healthy, help them deal with their anxiety, depression, anger problems. So we're trying to get them healthy enough to be able to communicate by identifying and expressing what they're feeling, get rid of this secrecy and this inability to talk openly. When it comes to responsibility, The responsibility is to identify the triggers, the sources to the problems, and then take action steps. A lot of times it's misleading about, well, if you diagnose this as a disease, then you're just giving them an excuse. And that's not the case whether it's with the alcoholic addict or with the family members. The opposite is true. When we diagnose a problem, you now have the opportunity to take responsibility to manage that disease. So that's the key phrasing, manage the disease. So whether it's the alcoholic addict or the family members, we give them what they need in the way of information and what recovery is all about, so they can take responsibility and manage their disease. Same thing with going back into the past. Especially with adult children of alcoholics, if they've been stuck growing up, you have to unstuck them. And so that means you do have to go back to the past and say, wait a minute, you were victimized. There were some problems in your past that you should not have had to contend with. You coped with them in some unhealthy ways, which you're continuing to do. Now, what kind of action steps can we take to remedy the situation? So in terms of therapy, we do have to go back, but it's not psychoanalysis. We're not staying stuck in that. See, that was a Freudian slip, me stumbling over psychoanalysis. We're not staying stuck in the past. We're basically saying, let's give you a reality check on what damaged you. Let's repair it, and you take action steps to improve your life. So we're not keeping people stuck by going to the past. Okay. More questions.
Well, I just had a question about, you had stressed earlier that we need to identify and offer services to codependents. Is there any kind of a campaign that's been developed to reach out so that people are aware, using public information spots, or is there anything like that happening or planned? Or
what about in this county? Have you seen anything? I mean, the support groups have always been out there, Al-Anon, CODA, FA, but they do not do much promotion. That isn't their role. They're
right.
Support groups. In terms of taking active steps like what we're talking about, has the county done anything, Susan?
We haven't stepped out a lot. I have probably been one of the most vocal people out there because of the stigma and discrimination that's still here. It hasn't been an environment where people have felt safe to step forward and say that they're in recovery. It is something I'm working on. There is a national movement on that. I went to a training up in San Francisco in the Bay Area that I want to bring down here to help people that have benefited, whether they're family members or employers or anybody that's seen the results of people getting into recovery, and we can bring that here to help people understand that they can really get out and advocate to show people that it works, because we have no idea what the numbers are. There's just no way to know in an audience how many people out there would be in recovery, because that is part of a person's, a lot of people are very, very private about that. But we're working.
My remarks is more general of the field across the nation. And my assumption would be, like in any area, you've got private therapists, you have the community mental health therapists, you've got people who are as invested in this area as I am, who are out there in the trenches doing this kind of work and doing this kind of hustling stuff. So it could be real helpful to tap into the people who are already experienced, already doing this stuff, and give them some help in doing that. So, but this is, again, my comments are more generalized at our field, not just meaning the county here.
Go ahead. Just a caveat, kind of an add-on. It's my understanding that Medicare legislation has just been passed with the mental health equity funding that will provide funding for mental health on par or equal to the physical health fund. So that's at least a step in the right direction, not at the federal level. So.
Okay. Okay. Well, I thank you again for letting me come speak. Hope it was helpful.
And thank you very much.
Look forward to working with you in the future.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Oh, yes,
yeah, I just wanted to thank you for being willing to come in and speak to us on this, because I think this is one of the issues we need, is just to have more community education. The more we understand, then the more we can work together and collaborate and begin to bring the services in. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for being here. Now, moving on. On our agenda is a public, the health agency director report, Mr. Hamm.
Thank you. Good evening. Dr. Bornstein started last week, and she would have been happy to be here tonight, but we sent her to Sacramento, so she misses you already. You'll get to meet her next month. It's a strange time in California as far as the budget is concerned. The Senate Republican Caucus actually put a budget proposal together. I think it's the first time they did so. CSAC, California State Association of Counties, came out against it immediately. They issued a letter. Paul McIntosh, who's the executive director of CSAC, on behalf of all the counties, to the members of the Senate. It's basically about $1.5 billion of cuts to health and human services programs. The Republicans have consistently upheld their pledge to oppose any tax increases, and they're characterizing almost anything as a tax increase, including what the Democrats are calling some, you know, closing tax loopholes and reverting tax rates back to the way had, you know, where they had been in the not too distant past. So I was up in Sacramento last week. What I had heard consistently was that the Democrats had gotten increasingly frustrated. They felt like they had compromised and compromised and compromised and compromised, and the Republicans just weren't budging. And so then the Republican proposal finally comes out, and it's as damaging a proposal to county health and human services programs as you could imagine. So doesn't look like we're getting any closer to resolution. And in the meantime, the county health agency programs aren't dramatically impacted the way some community-based organizations are by the looming cash problem that the state will run into. Some debate up there amongst experts about when the state will have to borrow money. And it's probably still a couple weeks out, but that's what I know a lot of the legislative leadership, both sides of the aisle, were hoping to avoid, was having to borrow money. When in a situation where they don't have a budget, the rates are horrendous. It affects further the state's already terrible tax credit rating, not tax credit rating, borrowing. It's credit rating. So it's a whole bunch of bad news coming out of Sacramento for our programs right now. Isn't that lovely? Dr. Bornstein started last week. Did I mention that?
Jeff, is that why she's in Sacramento?
No, it just was coincidental. California Conference of Local Health Officers, which is one of her two organizations statewide, was having a couple days of meetings associated with a NACHO conference that happens to be a National Association of Counties that's happening up in Sacramento this week. So Dr. McMillan went up there with her, and it was an opportunity for him to introduce her to her new peer group and expose her to the bizarre situation that Sacramento is these days. Couple things are going to be on the Board of Supervisors agenda, their first meeting in October, which is the 7th, which will be before your next meeting. So I'll brief you on them. The board held a public hearing on a proposed tobacco retail licensing ordinance, and they ultimately continued the hearing because they wanted to add a component to the ordinance that we had been led to believe the board, majority of the board members, may not support, which was a prohibition on the sale of tobacco products in bars. The tobacco retail licensing ordinance is really focused on enhancing efforts to enforce the existing prohibition on the sale of tobacco products to minors. And there was a little controversy when we first introduced it. Not all the board members were super supportive of it, only because the only way you can fund it is through a fee that you charge the licensees, and which is about $350 in our county to cover the cost of the program's administration. And a couple board members were legitimately concerned about adding additional costs to the operation of retail businesses in the community at a time when the economy is not very strong. So we were trying to stay right down the middle of the line on the ordinance in its initial submittal. A couple of the cities, in fact, I think all of the cities, four cities have adopted, or three? Several cities had adopted ordinances already, three, I think. Each included a prohibition on the sale of tobacco in licensed establishments licensed principally for the sale of alcoholic beverages for consumption on the premises. That's the official, we just say bars, but I mean, that's the way it reads in the ordinance. And so the majority of the board members told us to bring it back with that language included, and so that's what we're doing. And they will presumably adopt it a week from tomorrow on the 16th. Their further consideration of whether the Animal Services Division, currently a division of the Sheriff's Office, whether it should come back as a freestanding department or come back as a department or division of the health agency, they took it up a couple weeks ago. They decided to narrow the seven alternatives for how it should be organized down to those two, freestanding department or health agency, and they'll decide finally whether they want to do, which of those two they want to do on October 7th. And smart money is on at least the administrative office recommending that it be embedded in the health agency. So folks who testified, Undersheriff Bolts, representative of the union, SLOCIA, as well as the employees, all indicated their support for the other alternative, freestanding department. But so we'll see what happens on October 7th. And I saw a question.
Jeff, I just realized that Woods Humane Society is out there in the same proximity. Are they affiliated now, or they just happen to be in close physical proximity?
They work closely together in that Woods takes the adoptable animals from the shelter that they feel they can help find a home. So they take mostly dogs. I don't think they're taking any cats right now. Woods has a limited capacity to shelter cats, and I heard that they had some concerns about the county shelter's cattery, about it not being in very good condition and contributing to unusually high rates of kitty respiratory illness of some kind. So the county actually has a project on the books. The board has been hesitant to pull the trigger on it because of the uncertain role of Woods as a shelter operator, and there was serious consideration given over the past several months to models that included the county getting out of the shelter operation business and having Woods handle that whole part of it. But Woods isn't prepared to do that right now. They don't have the capacity, and so that wasn't an option that the board chose. But we certainly, the county works very closely with them and would continue to. Jesse.
Thank you, Jeff. I have questions on two different topics. One, I wanted to thank you for following up on the Valley Fever complaint from California Valley. But I had two questions on that. Isn't it safe to assume that there very probably are Valley Fever spores in that dust cloud?
I'm really not an MD and hesitant to speculate about that.
Okay.
I do know from Dr. McMillan's briefings and from what I've read, and in fact the briefing that he provided to the commission, that the spores need a little depth for the temperature and the moisture level that keeps them alive, which is why grading has a tendency to be a very likely activity to result in allowing those spores up into the dust, because it gets down deep enough. Now, I don't know, California Valley's dry, little sheep hooves on the surface, certainly making a lot of dust, but I don't know, in terms of speculating about the relative risk of spores being present in that dust versus dust created by grading activities, I don't know.
Okay. And the county doesn't have any way, or they just don't test. They wouldn't go out there and get some of that dust and test it to see if there were spores in it.
I don't think it's something that we do.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why.
Right.
I don't know that if it's a limitation just in our ability to gather a sufficient sample, or if it's a limitation in the lab. It's a good question. I'd be happy to get an answer to that for you.
Oh, good. Thank you. Okay, the second one is I'm looking at the SOUPS agenda for tomorrow, and there's an item here that looks like a good thing. So I wanted you to fill us in on this A10. You're getting a contract to provide sober living housing to individuals. Can you fill us in on how many people will be housed by this and what's going on?
I can't.
Good. Thank you.
No, I said I can't.
Oh, you can't?
No.
Oh, okay. And why is that?
Because we have 4 to 6 agenda items on the board's consent calendar every week. They're produced by folks expert in those areas of responsibility, Wayne Hansen in this case, and I don't have all of the details of all of them memorized. So I know that they are repeat contracts. I don't believe that this is a new thing that we're doing.
Oh, I see.
I think it's a continuation of a relationship that's existed for some time, which is why it's on the consent calendar. But if Sue has more information on it, that'd be great.
The only new one out of there is Choices, which is a new sober living home over in Atascadero that just, I think they've been in operation about a year. Our concern is that with Prop 36 and drug courts, with a number of folks that come through there, and that's why the county's contracting with them, is so that the beds are available for them. And it used to be that Casa Solana and Project Amend would have beds available for the general public, for somebody to come in, that we could refer to them. But now they may have a few beds, but we don't have as much availability for the general public because of Prop 36 and drug court, which is a good thing, that they're allowing people to go into treatment, but it's using up the precious resources that we do have. So, but we do have Choices in, which is new, which expands by a few beds, and but there's still a big need.
And on those two programs, they're still shrinking a little bit, the Prop 36 program and the drug court program. And I met with Supervisor Gibson this afternoon, and that was his question. You know, how much smaller, and how will that specifically affect the quality or quantity of services? Are you expecting reduced outcomes, or are you going to maintain the same quality of service but provide it to fewer folks? I don't want to go back to the state budget, but an additional $10 million cut that the governor has proposed to Prop 36, an already underfunded program that with a demonstrated outcomes of success in terms of saving money in terms of the prison population, you know, by diverting these folks to appropriate prevention and, well, no, it's not prevention, but it's at least treatment and then educational programs. The other thing that will be on, besides the board's decision about animal services on the October 7th, they will also hear from Kurt Batson and me on the mosquito abatement benefit assessment ballot measure that the board, I think it's fair to say, reluctantly directed us to go ahead and proceed with. So where we have gotten now is Kurt has convened and worked very, very closely with an advisory body made up of about 10 or 12 folks, sort of representing cities and the agricultural community and the business community and interested parties to develop a couple different scenarios for what our mosquito abatement program would look like if we had the benefit of a dedicated revenue stream that would result from a benefit assessment ballot measure under AB 218, which is the method that we're proceeding to test the public's willingness to tax themselves further for something like a dedicated vector control program. The reason I think that the survey that we conducted indicated that there was a 95% chance that such a thing would pass, which is why the Board of Supervisors said, okay, yeah, go ahead and pursue it further, is a single-family residential unit equivalent, the value of the benefit measure would be about $9 for a year for a single-family residential unit. And I think there are a lot of folks who are willing to pay that much to have an increased program to suppress, you know, the vectors that carry disease, primarily mosquitoes, but ticks and fleas, etc., and other things. There has been a state Supreme Court decision within the last several months, ultimately overturning the validity of a similar, but we think sufficiently different measure that Santa Clara County put before its voters and passed, that was to establish an open space district. So to generate a revenue stream off of property taxes that would be used to acquire property. Santa Clara County, of course, used to be all open space, and now there's very, very little of it left. But the voters supported the creation of a tax benefit assessment for an open space district, and the court concluded that it was inconsistent with the requirements of the law, in that it didn't provide a more substantial benefit to property owners than it did to the general public, which was one of the requirements apparently in the statute. And it got all the way to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court held in favor of the anti-tax group that had filed the measure, that had filed the lawsuit in the first place. You guys are probably the first group to publicly hear any even moderate analysis of this issue as it relates to our plans to move forward with a benefit assessment ballot measure. So far, we don't have anything official from County Council, but what we've been able to glean from other stakeholders throughout the state, mostly Kurt's peers, directors of environmental health from other counties, is that we think the mosquito abatement vector control program arguably does provide a specific benefit to property owners that would be incrementally higher than to the general public. I don't know if you're camping in Morro Bay at a certain time over the last couple months. I understand mosquitoes are pretty bad out there. So that certainly helps the visitors who are camping in our campgrounds. But that's one of the things that we're going to have to brief the board on when we go back to them in October. We certainly do not want to be the first county to follow the state Supreme Court's decision on the Santa Clara County matter and have a tax group challenge the validity of our, you know, once we've spent $250,000 to get the thing engineered and before the voters and to have it pass, to generate almost $1 million a year for us to use for vector control programs, you know, relieving the general fund of its $200,000 obligation, and taking one of our programs off the hit list forever, to have it overturned, you know, in a court battle would be a bad thing. So those things are both going to the board on October 7th. I had wanted to talk a little bit about ombudsman services. I know you guys are very, very interested in that, and give you some status on the CHC contract negotiations. And what I would prefer to do is bring back a more detailed report to you next month, when I hope I'll have some very specific information to share on both those things. So,
could you also include in that report, I got a couple emails over the weekend about CHC closing the pharmacy in Atascadero and that patients were going to have to come into San Luis Obispo to pick up medications?
Sure. I know they have proposed to us that we allow them to close the pharmacy in Atascadero, and they want to move out of that building, which I think they are. I think they've done. They've moved into their own building in Atascadero. And we have told them so far, I can just tell you, that we would only be willing to consider that if they demonstrated that they had alternative means for folks north of the grade to obtain their prescriptions. That driving to San Luis Obispo didn't make sense to us. They are increasingly trying to go to contracts as opposed to operating, say, pharmacy services on their own, which in concept we told them that we were comfortable with them doing.
This was particularly confusing to me in view of the fact that I understand that they're expanding services to include San Miguel, but they're closing the pharmacies, and I guess that didn't make much sense.
Well, they are, I don't, again, I'm always reluctant to speak for them, but they have told us over and over and over that we need to be supportive of their efforts to operate more efficiently, so that they can continue to make the most of their limited financial resources to provide services, which we agree with. And I think that what they're contemplating doing for pharmacy as well as for some specialty services is have arrangements with other providers in the community to which they can refer their patients to receive the same services, rather than have them, you know, those specialty physicians on their staff in their clinics, or in the case of pharmacy in Atascadero, operating the pharmacy right there in the building. We're okay with that as long as the services continue to be available. if they want to change the method of providing the services, you know, we're trying not to micromanage the way they run their business. So.
They moved out of the old hospital building?
Yes.
And what are we doing with that building?
we are planning how to most efficiently use it. One of the first things that came up, Pam, is we thought, well, you know, we own most of the space that Drug and Alcohol Services occupies in Atascadero. I forget how many, 10 or 15 years ago we purchased it, and it was a real smart move. It's not enough space, and we actually do lease some space for some other activities up there. We're looking at every possible alternative for more efficiently utilizing the space that we own. So we will come up with a proposal. There's a team of folks just this last week who have convened to try and, you know, tour the space, figure out what it would lend itself to in terms of use. How much money would we need to invest in it, you know, to make it suitable for whatever we want to do with it. When it first came up, CHC told us they wanted to move out of that space. And my first thought was to move Drug and Alcohol Services in and sell the property that we own that they currently occupy. So we're looking at any ideas that anybody has, that even the ones that seem silly, we're looking at them all.
Are you collaborating with the city of Atascadero in any way, as far as
on that point? I don't
use in the community.
Not to my knowledge. Well, tell me more about what. I mean, I'd be open to contacting them. What kind of collaboration were you thinking of?
I don't know if I had anything specific in mind, but I think because you're doing business in the city of Atascadero, it might be nice to have a conversation with the mayor, you know, the city council, and ask if they have ideas that would enhance services in that particular community. Because I know if I'm getting emails, it's only going to get more, you know.
Are you getting emails?
Yes, I'm getting emails about the pharmacy and the moving of the CHC clinic.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, the space they acquired, into which they moved in the Atascadero, they've had for some time.
No, and I'm not begrudging that, but I just think, you know, maybe having a collaborative type effort with the city of Atascadero might, you know, be worth your while.
Thank you.
And it's Mayor Brenler.
Well, I'll speak to the idea about moving Drug and Alcohol Services up there, because I think that's a good idea, because where it's at, the parking has been a mess from day one. And the fact is, and it's also very confusing with all the other outlying units that they've had to rent, and it seems like that would be an appropriate and good use of
yes.
the building.
The preliminary feedback was it wasn't enough space for everything that we do over there off of El Camino Real, just north of the town, so I don't know. I wasn't part of the team.
Have to get back to the state budget. Sorry. last meeting, we had someone from SenCal talk to us, said that it may not be affecting them for a little while. They've got some reserves. You tell us the health agency is okay for right now, but we're in unprecedented times, so they've gone beyond the time they've ever gone beyond. And I know some health agencies, like skilled nursing facilities, are being hurt by it. Where will we start feeling this? Let's say it keeps going. Where is it going to start hitting our health services in the county? What's going to be hit first?
That's a really good question. The point I was trying to make earlier was with regard to the cash flow implications of the absence of the state budget and our department not really being directly impacted by that to the extent that we might have been in another time, because we don't get a lot of the straight Medi-Cal for physical medical care service reimbursement kind of services anymore, because we're not in that business anymore. I know, as Bob Freeman reported last month, SenCal Health has chosen not to reduce rates, and so they'll continue to make payments at the current rate, and that was the point Bob was making about the advantage of their very successful history over their 25 years and their ability to generate the kind of reserves that they've been able to generate. Again, there are folks probably much more expert on this point than I, but I know you mentioned skilled nursing facilities. I know there are a lot of folks who were not realigned under the county organized health system. That's not true. Skilled nursing facilities are part of the SNCal Health network. So it's a good question. I think the answer might have been different under the old fee-for-service environment than it is now. That's another thing I guess I'm going to have to ask you to let me follow up on, because I think because of SNCal Health's presence here as our Medi-Cal managed care plan, they're going to be able to mitigate a lot of the problems that would otherwise exist through the absence of the state budget or through direct cuts in Medi-Cal reimbursement rates under the old fee-for-service system that won't impact providers in SLO or Santa Barbara counties now because of the existence of the managed care plan. I know that I have not been, I don't know if Pam's getting any emails on this, I'm not getting any phone calls on this. And I haven't been meeting with the CHC folks on a regular basis. Marsha's been doing an excellent job of that. But they get their first payment from SNCal Health, and then they get their FQHC cost-based reimbursement allocation through the state. And I think it's that part that might be impacting them in terms of cash flow, absent an adopted state budget. But if they've been talking with Marsha about it, it hasn't come up in any of the briefing notes that Marsha's provided me on our contract negotiations.
Jeff, it seems like a lot of our conversations, particularly during your report, revolve around SNCal and what's happening, CHC and what's happening with them. And I think it would be, again, to reiterate what I have voiced in the past, on some kind of maybe even quarterly basis, to have a CHC rep at the meeting just to kind of have a dialogue would be really nice.
I'd be happy to invite them.
Thank you.
That concludes my report, unless you have any other questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, then. We'll move on the agenda to our updates, we'll start with my update. I wanted to talk briefly about the Economic Vitality Corporation Healthcare Task Force that I mentioned the last couple of meetings ago, and they have concluded their meetings. They've identified a current and future shortage of healthcare professionals in SLO County as their major focus. They have created a health professional needs assessment survey. There was a possible thought to include some efforts toward more public awareness, and especially within the business community, of wellness programs, but after having looked at what is available in this county, I think they decided that that was already being well handled by other organizations, and why recreate the wheel? So of course the EBC is interested in the healthcare availability in this county because it relates to people moving here and wanting to know that they can get the kind of healthcare that they want. Obviously we want businesses to come to our county, provide tax revenues, so on and so forth. So that's that one. And then the other group that I report on is the Tobacco Control Coalition, and I don't have to mention anything now about the ordinance because Jeff already did that. I do want to commend that group. They have two health education specialists who've been very active, and I'm basically taking this report from their minutes. They are having a meeting tomorrow, but from their August minutes. They did say, among other things, an underage tobacco sting was tentatively scheduled for the end of August in Paso Robles. Now, I don't know if that actually occurred or did it rope in anybody, but those are the kinds of things they're working on. Pismo Beach has decided to proceed with an underage tobacco sting operation with the Tobacco Control Program as well. They also are continuing to meet with the cities, Morro Bay and Atascadero in particular, trying to get ordinances that will provide smoke-free parks. And they're actually meeting with all of the cities, but they've been so far, I think their most successful efforts have been with the Morro Bay and Atascadero councils. What else? They're working on trying to establish policies in the cities for outdoor smoke-free event areas. So now we're talking about I don't want to pick on the Mid-State Fair, but just that would be probably an idea of where it would be perhaps better for everyone's health if it were smoke-free. And then local legislative district days are coming up in this month, and the Tobacco Control Coalition already has appointments with our legislators, and they have been over the past few years meeting with them and expressing our concerns and activity. And I can't say enough about that group, how well they're organized and what a good job they're doing with the funds that they've been provided. That is all I have to report on, and so now we'll move. Oh, all right.
Should be an easy one. When you said smoke-free parks, does that mean those cities are looking at maybe one or two parks within their city being smoke-free, or all of their parks being smoke-free?
I think they're looking at an ordinance that says parks where kids are playing should be smoke-free. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of benefits to that. One of the big benefits is the litter situation.
Yes, yes.
So we've worked on smoke-free beaches. Next is smoke-free parks. Did you want to comment, Commissioner Heather?
Well, just to remind everybody that Coastal Cleanup Day is on the 20th, and that's where we get the brunt of our butts.
Okay. So we'll go to the other commissioner reports. We'll start on my left with Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chairman Enns. I will try to go to the HIV Care Consortium meeting. It does meet. There's a conflict next month, but they do start their meeting about an hour before this one. So I'll try to get in there and touch base and then give you the full report at the November meeting. The other thing I wanted to mention was I did drop off a copy of the corn survey on everyone. That's because as a consumer representative, this is an issue that consumers are interested in. Consumers want labeling, and I think the flyer is self-explanatory, but if there are any questions, I will do my best to answer them. Thank you.
Commissioner Shimousis?
I did attend the Adult Services Policy Council meeting for September. The August meeting primarily centered on development of their ASPC goals and work plan for the fiscal year 2008-09. On the September meeting, quite a bit of information. I do have a flyer if some of our AV folks want to trot up during the presentation. Inspection reports on restaurants, grocery stores, and markets in terms of health agency is available online, www.slocounty.ca.gov, and follow the links. You can find out which of our stores, markets, and restaurants have filed any kind of information on the report on health-related issues. There's the fourth annual suicide prevention program occurring on October 7th. The information will be, well, that was very speedy. It's a community education event open to all. It's sponsored by hospice. There are, among some other agencies, there are CEUs available, and as far as I know, it is free. It's Tuesday, October 7th at Laguna Middle School in San Luis Obispo. And finally, the Senior Nutrition Program offers a $20 coupon book for seniors that can be redeemed at all farmers markets throughout the county. $20 worth of food at any booth of your choice in a farmer's market. So again, you can contact the senior nutrition program for that. And that does it.
Commissioner Hetherington?
The Domestic Violence Task Force meets next week. They only meet every other month, and that's all I have to report.
Commissioner Garena?
No report.
Commissioner Warren?
No report. The Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board didn't meet last month.
All right, then we'll move on to the committee reports. Legislative?
Legislative and Budget Committee will probably not meet until sometime maybe toward the end of the year. It's kind of in status hold mode.
Okay, but I'll still ask you every month to repeat that.
I will.
Did you have a question, Commissioner Arnold?
Yes, please. Penny, as we all know, due to our, I mean, everyone here knows better than I do, the shortage of doctors that we're ruled a rural county and that our Medicare reimbursement is too low. And I'm sure the supervisors have been addressed on this subject, but I'm wondering if it isn't time for the Legislative Committee to propose that we act as far as sending a reminder to the supervisors that they should be lobbying on this issue to get something done here so that we do have proper reimbursement, so we do have doctors who can afford to live here. So,
I know that Lois Capps is very active on that point and very supportive of trying to get those reimbursement rates changed.
Well, that's fine. Most of our county is represented by Kevin McCarthy.
Well, I'd be more than happy to entertain correspondence, you know, from the committee with the Health Commission's approval and support.
What was that you were going to do?
At legislative, probably at, I would assume the best place would be at the Legislative Committee meeting to maybe put
that
together some kind of correspondence and discuss that.
Okay.
Maybe we will have a meeting then.
Thank you, Penny.
Thanks.
Community education?
We haven't met, but I think possibly we should have a meeting before the sludge ordinance comes out and maybe educate our community on what we see as the pitfalls of land application. I don't think the commission has ever supported land application, especially if the testing levels haven't improved. I think we have a big cause for concern. We know last year we did the information about no drugs down the drain. You know, the sewer plants are still getting pills floating in effluent. So we know that, you know, that's going to be a long educational process to get people to change behaviors. But I think, too, that maybe the Community Ed Committee would want to weigh in on that in a public way, via the web page or whatever.
So. Good idea. You already mentioned Budget Committee. Now, Nominating Committee, Commissioner O'Dell's not here. Are you, Commissioner Reina, are you going to be the person to?
I can.
All right.
We discussed... are making a recommendation for two members to join the commission, Pamela Munson and Martin Craven. And I'm not sure if we have contacted them. We have, and they're both still interested. And so the recommendations from that nominating committee is to move and have them accepted on this commission.
All right, there have been two new members proposed, and we need to take action. So I would entertain a motion to accept the recommendations of the nominating committee.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that we accept the recommendations of the nominating committee to appoint Pamela Munson and Marvin Craven, or to recommend to the Board of Supervisors that they appoint Pamela Munson and Martin Craven to be commissioners. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain. Motion has passed unanimously. Okay, now we have a further recommendation.
There is a second part, and that is to change the language in I believe it's the bylaws, that state that please attach two letters of reference to people who apply for membership. And since in one of the, some of the cases, we get no letters of recommendation, and we had a discussion on letters of recommendation and really how useless they are. They're typically written by the one asking for the recommendation. And so we'd like to have, to clear it up, we'd like to change the wording to say a letter of recommendation, or a letter of reference, desirable but not required.
If you're asking for a bylaws change, that's a different horse than just
a
change.
It's not in the bylaws, it's just on the application.
It's just on the application?
It's on the application.
Okay, yeah, well then we can certainly deal with that.
Okay. Well, I would like to speak on this issue. I did express reservations on this at the committee meeting, and after thinking it over and talking to a couple of citizens and one member of the Board of Supervisors, I've concluded this is not a good idea. It's an honor and a privilege to serve on this body, and I think two letters of recommendation is a very minor thing to ask somebody to do. And also, it's a good outreach tool. You know, I would go even further, since this subject has come up, that someone who wants to be on the commission would just run a petition, get some of their neighbors or someone at their church or their youth group or Boy Scout troop, you know, just because very few people know about the commission. It would be a way for more people to learn about the commission and what it's doing and what the health department is doing. So I certainly don't think we should lower our standards and backtrack on this. I think we should stick with what we have. Two letters are not onerous at all. So I will oppose this.
Okay. Now, this recommendation has come, however, from the nominating committee, and so it is now up to this body to either someone in the body to make a motion, or maybe nobody makes a motion. That would be entirely up to the commissioners. So at this point, I would entertain a motion to make this change.
May I take a step back, and perhaps then this should go back to the nominating committee for further discussion to a point where we all are in agreement. So, and so what I'm recommending is we do not vote on this right now, that we take it back to the nominating committee and we get some more discussion on it. Because I can't really talk to it because I wasn't the one who pushed it, and so we really need to discuss it.
Commissioner Hetherington, you had a comment?
I agree with Commissioner Arnold. I think, you know, serving on the commission is an honor, and I think that, you know, part of the process, even getting a job or, you know, volunteering a lot of times, they want to know what your background is.
And well, that was what we discussed, and a letter of reference doesn't do that. Now, if you have references that we can call, sure, that does it.
Right.
But if you ask somebody for a letter of recommendation, you know, they're sitting in front of you. What are they going to say? Yeah, well, I'm going to write something really poor about you. You know, that's not going to happen. But if you had actual references you can follow, I mean, that's what I do, is I follow the references.
Yeah.
But, and so that, it was more of a meaningless, it was a meaningless thing. I think that was what the thought was. But I think if we have some discussion, we need to take it back. And,
yeah, I would hope that you have more discussion about that. I think the reference calling is probably on the same level, though. You're only going to get people to call that like you. But,
maybe
you know.
Don't know.
But we would never know either way.
All right. There is no motion on this recommendation, and therefore the subject is, there is no action. All right. And now the last item on the agenda is the prospective future items. And we have a program next month. Commissioner Hetherington is heading up putting together of it, I guess.
I'm not on it.
On domestic violence, a domestic violence panel, and that should be extremely interesting and informative. So is there anything else that, I think that's, you're pretty, I think we'll pretty well fill the evening with that, don't you?
I think so, but I can confirm that after the meeting next week, because that's
okay.
What we're going to discuss is time allocation.
Okay. Mr. Broadhurst did ask if we would...
Broadhurst.
Broadhurst. Yeah, different. Listen, I didn't call him Broadbent. That was an English guy. Sorry, David, if you're watching. Anyway, he did ask that we bring up the sludge, get a report on the sludge, so you might just take a look at our proposed agenda topics, and if you have any recommendations as to where we might fit that in, let me know. I know that we have pesticides coming up as a subject in November, but I understand that is going to be a very full program. So although it would fit in kind of nicely with that.
I can check that time allocation, too.
Yeah.
I know they asked for more time than what we had. So.
I mean, it does, you know, sludge doesn't exactly fit in with domestic violence, but if we end up having time there, you know, we could maybe before we have our panel have a quick report or something like that. And if we don't do it before this particular, during this public comment period, it isn't over. We still have opportunity to make public comment next year. So we won't have lost an opportunity to be educated prior to the actual ordinance being established. So is there any other business? All right, then. Thank you all very much for being here, and this meeting is adjourned.